Chapter 8. A Bitter Pill. I was called into Mr. Green's office right after lunch. There were several chairs in Mr. Green's office. A plush, comfortable one used for setting kids' minds at ease. A beanbag for less formal counseling sessions. And then there was the old wooden chair. A worn-out, high-backed, dark monster with wide arm sets. Kids called it the electric chair. This was the chair he had positioned in front of his desk when I was escorted into his office that morning. "Come in, Jared. Have a seat," he said. I sat down in the uncomfortable chair, figuring I would hear the same old stuff about how he thought I was the center of all local evil. But all he said was, "I like your shirt." I looked down and noticed that this was the same shirt I had worn on the days when Alec had commented on my shirt as well. "I like your tie," I told him. "Have you spoken to my parents yet?" "We've been missing each other's calls." And then he sat there and just stared at me. "Listen, is this important? Because I'm missing English class." "I will ask you this once," he said, "and I expect an honest answer." "Sure." "Did you put a skunk in Alex Smarts' minivan?" "No, I did not." I said it as directly as I could. He leaned back in his chair with a slight look of satisfaction on his face. "You might want to think about your answer." And then he reached into his drawer, pulled out a tiny plastic bag, and tossed it on his desk. At first, I thought the bag was empty, but then I saw something in it. Something small. Something round and blue. It was a shirt button that looked very familiar. I looked down at the shirt I was wearing. The button was identical to my shirt buttons. And when I reached up to my collar, I found that the top button was missing. Suddenly, I felt the hardness of the electric chair. And I knew what Mr. Green's look of satisfaction was all about. It was the look of an executioner preparing to throw the switch. "Do you know where this button was found?" he said. I shook my head. "It was found on Alex Smarts' driveway, right near the spot where his van was parked that night." He reached out and took the button away from me. "Maybe you'd like to reconsider your answer." I could only stammer, because I knew that no matter what I said, it would sound like a lie. "Don't you have anything to say for yourself?" "It's not my button," I said weakly, but we both knew that it had to be mine. The question was, how had it gotten there? I had never been on Alex Smarts' driveway. "I'm going to give you one final chance, Jared," he said, with the patience of somebody completely sure of himself. "I'd like to put an end to this situation by tomorrow. Otherwise, it might get ugly." But I wasn't listening to him anymore. I was thinking about that button. There were only two possibilities. Either Alec was lying about where he found the button, or someone had intentionally put it there for Alec to find. But who, I thought. Who could have gotten that button? Then it dawned on me, in growing disbelief, that there was only one person in the school who had access to my shirts. When I got home that afternoon, Tyson was already there, sitting in the living room with his headphones on, blasting his ears with one of my CDs. I pulled his headphones off and his eyes snapped open. "Hey, what gives?" he asked. I wanted to grab him and shake him. I wanted to accuse him right there and pass judgment on him the way that Green had passed judgment on me. But I had done that once before to Tyson, hadn't I? I had beaten him silly, convinced that he was the one pulling the deadly pranks last fall. But I'd been dead wrong. Maybe Green was ready to throw the switch on me, but I wasn't going to do that to Tyson. No matter what I suspected, he deserved the benefit of my doubt. I took a deep breath to steady myself and said, "How do you like my shirt?" He looked at me like I was nuts. "It's okay," he said. "Notice anything wrong with it?" He looked at my chest and pointed to it. "You got some mustard there." I looked down, and he dragged his finger up across my face. "Gets him every time," he said. I pushed his hand away, and he finally realized that this was not a laughing matter. "What's your problem today, huh? Remember when you said you hated me?" He rolled his eyes. "Are we going to go through that again? Do you hate me enough to get me suspended? Do you hate me enough to get me thrown out of school?" He sat up and answered me with the same directness I answered Mr. Green. "No," he said. "I don't. I hate you enough to take an extra hamburger at dinner, so you don't get seconds. Do you hate me enough to plant evidence on Alex's driveway? Are you accusing me of something?" He started to get that red-in-the-face look that he always got when somebody lit his microscopic fuse. "I'm just asking." I watched him closely, trying to gauge the truth in his answer. "No, I didn't." He thought for a moment, then said, "There was a time when I hated you more than anything, and there are still times when I want to hate you, but I just can't. And unless you do something really stupid, I probably never will." Then he stormed across the room and turned to face me again, but he kept his distance. "You're my best friend, okay? There, I said it. The guy who ruined my life is now my best friend. Pretty pathetic, huh?" "No, it's not," I said, feeling like a total jerk. There was no doubting his honesty about it. "It is pathetic," Tyson insisted, "because I know you're not really my friend at all." "What?" "You feel sorry for me. You feel guilty for what you did, but you don't really like me." "That's not true. Prove it," he said. I opened my mouth to speak, but nothing came out. I couldn't prove to Tyson that I was his friend, any more than I couldn't prove my innocence to Green. "We'll never be on an equal ground," said Tyson, "unless I ruin your life, and then you turn around and save it. Then, if you can tell me we're friends, that's when I'll believe you." I don't know if Green had spoken to my parents, because they didn't talk to me about it. That, I think, was as unsettling as if I had been punished for something I didn't do. Still, I tried to convince myself that it was all over, that Three Dirty Tricks was the charm that would break the spell, and whoever was doing it would slink back into whatever hole they crawled out of. But, like I said, something was set loose in our school, and Alec, simply being Alec, kept making himself the target. But what he did next, his own little counterattack, was as unforgivable as any of the pranks pulled against him. It wasn't a prank that he pulled, but it was despicable nonetheless. It was as mean-spirited as it was self-serving, but all it served to do was feed the fires of resentment. It happened on the day of the candidates' televised statements. About a year ago, our school had converted the audiovisual office into a television studio of sorts, and the school got wired for closed-circuit TV. This year, for the first time, each presidential candidate had recorded a 5-minute campaign speech that would be televised throughout the entire 9th grade. I watched it in social studies class, a class I didn't share with either Cheryl or Alec. Tommy Nichols came on first. The highlight of his rather dull speech was a top 10 list, the top 10 reasons why he should be voted in. It was supposed to be very funny, but in fact it was so unfunny that people were laughing hysterically by the end of it. Unfortunately, they were laughing at Tommy, and not with him. Next came Katerina's speech, which seemed like one long, rambling telephone conversation with herself. Cheryl's speech was masterful, as I knew it would be, and then came Alex. No one, not even me, was prepared for what he did. "Hello, friends and classmates," his speech began. "It is with great regret that I share with you some information I discovered just the other day. Something that every one of you has the right to know." We all listened closely, wondering what sort of bombshell Alec had to drop. Like everything else he did, it felt like a nuke. "The video you are about to see was filmed a few days ago," he said on the TV. "I ask you all to watch closely." Suddenly, the image of Alec changed to a handheld video shot of a place I recognized. A place filled with old, crumbling boats. "Oh no," I said to myself. "He didn't." But unfortunately, he did. The video had been edited down to less than a minute, and within that minute, I saw Tyson and myself climb up the hull of the tugboat, and then Abby, Darren, OP, Jason, and Randall. Finally, the camera zoomed in to catch Cheryl, the image grainy and wobbly. She looked around as if she was up to no good, and there, the video ended. Alec came back on the screen. I slunk low in my chair. "Several months ago," he said, "a group of 7 kids terrorized the school, and they called themselves the Shadow Club. You thought that they had been brought to justice. You thought that they were sorry for what they had done, but you thought wrong. If that's the kind of person you want leading your class into high school, then vote for Cheryl What's-Her-Face. Otherwise, you know where to cast your vote." I didn't see it, but I hear their breakup was spectacular. Jody Latimer told me, and she was never one to gossip, so the source was reliable. "Alec accused Cheryl of tearing down his posters," Jody said. "And Cheryl called Alec more four-letter words than I knew existed. Some of them had, like, 10 letters. It was a breakup that could make the record books. But this was about much more than that. Alec had incriminated us all with that video. Even though it showed nothing, really, it just showed enough to let everyone's imagination run rampant. I went to the tugboat to be alone, to convince myself that there was a way to deal with this. And I was strong enough to do it. I wasn't feeling strong at all. I was feeling weak, angry, and confused. That's when Cheryl showed up. "Permission to come on board?" she asked. "Permission granted." She climbed in through the hole in the hull, and we sat across from each other, as we had done so many times before in the old treehouse. A winter storm had taken down that treehouse this year, and most of its wood had been burned in her fireplace. Thinking about that bothered me more than I think it should have. "Someone find me a bear so I can put it in Alex's minivan," she said. "Careful, we might find ourselves on cable tonight." She shook her head, furious at herself. How could I have been so stupid to trust him? I'm never going to trust anyone ever again. I laughed. "Now you sound like me." Then I took a long look at her. I could see how much she was hurting. "Don't worry," I told her. "He'll get his someday." "Well, I hope he gets it soon." Then she threw up her knees, realizing what she was saying. There it was. That old resentment. "You want him hurt as much as he hurt you," I said. "And, I mean, what he did was really nasty. It's okay to feel that way. Are you my guidance counselor now?" I grinned. "Me or Green? Take your pick." Cheryl took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "Do you think he would have done it if he knew why we were all meeting? If I hadn't laughed at him the other day?" I fiddled with a nail that was sticking out of the hole. "Maybe, maybe not. You know him better than I do." That's what I thought. She considered it for a few moments and clenched her fists, still fighting her fury. "I swore that I would never feel that way about anyone ever again," Cheryl said. "I swore I would never be so angry that I'd wish awful things on someone." "Wishing and making it happen are two different things," I reminded her. "Yeah, but sometimes wishes come true." The Shadow Club might have been dead, but thanks to Alex Smarts, it had risen from the grave. Everyone from Principal Diller to the cafeteria servers believed that we were conspiring up a new reign of terror. Whether or not Alec realized what he did, he put the seven of us back in the center of attention. I was in Green's office first thing the next morning. I had expected it. He couldn't leave that incriminating video unanswered. Once I took my seat in the electric chair, he didn't waste any time beating around the bush. "It was made very clear to you last October," he began, "that if this so-called Shadow Club was ever caught meeting again, it would be grounds for dismissal. You're going to expel us because we talked for 5 minutes? You don't even know what we talked about." "I have an idea." "We were trying to figure out who's pulling the tricks on Alec. Ask the others. They'll tell you." "I'm sure that's what they'll tell me," Green said calmly, making it clear that he wouldn't believe it, no matter who told him. "But the only thing I know for sure is that you called the meeting, and that means you're the only one who's really in danger of being expelled." "Fine. Then take me to Principal Diller. Maybe he'll listen to me." "No, I won't bother Principal Diller with you. Because you're my problem, Jared. You've been my problem this entire school year, and I will make sure this is taken care of." "Go ahead," I shouted. "Tell my parents I'm a delinquent. I'm sure you've already told them." Green sighed. "Your parents," he said, "are very defensive of you." I wasn't expecting to hear that my parents would defend me in anything. While I grappled with what to make of that, there was a knock on the door, and a teacher poked her head inside. She stood with a girl who was upset about something that, mercifully, didn't involve me. "Mr. Green, could I have your help?" the teacher asked. Reluctantly, Green stood up from his desk. "I'm not done with you," Green told me. "You wait right here, and think very carefully about your future in this school. When I get back, I want to hear about your meeting, and about the pranks." He strode out, closing the door behind him, leaving me with my thoughts. But when I looked at his desk, I realized I had been left alone with his thoughts, too. There, on his desk, was my file. For an instant, I fought the urge to look at what he had written about me. But, in the end, I reached over and flipped open the file with one finger, tilting my head to look at it, afraid he'd notice if I moved. Although his handwriting was hard to read, one phrase in the latest report leaped out at me like a nasty jack-in-the-box. "Deeply troubled," it said, "with sociopathic tendencies." My first instinct was to laugh. Me? Troubled, I thought. I might have been in trouble from time to time. I might have done some pretty stupid things now and then, but it always seemed to me that my troubles were no deeper than a wading pool. My family life was okay. My frustrations were typical, I guess. Troubled? That was absolutely ridiculous. When I rebounded from my laughter, it was a second phrase that hit me hard. Sociopathic. I wasn't quite certain what the word meant, but I had my suspicions. I found a fat dictionary on Mr. Green's shelves and pulled it down to look up the word. Sociopath, it said. A person who lacks conscience or moral responsibility. I felt as if someone had just punched me in the stomach. I could feel the air squeeze out of my lungs, and I gasped to breathe it back in. There's a word for people like you, Brett Whateley had said. Had he been sneaking a peek at my file, too? I sat back down in the electric chair, slamming the dictionary closed. Then I closed my eyes and reached down into myself, really deep down, to prove to myself that Green was wrong, and just because he wrote it, it didn't make it so. I didn't have to go very deep at all to find the conscience Green thought was so lacking in me. It was alive and well, but it was totally hidden from his view. What Green was doing to me was like a witch trial. Hundreds of years ago, they used to try witches in a water test. They believed witches were made out of wood, and since wood floats, obviously a witch would float too. If the person sank and drowned in the well, then obviously that person wasn't a witch. I felt myself sinking into the bottom of that well now. My life and everything I cared about slipping away. I wasn't about to let that happen. I was stronger than that, stronger than Green, and it dawned on me exactly what I had to do. Mr. Green's supposed evidence of my crimes sat in a little plastic bag clipped to my file. The blue shirt button. I slipped it out of the bag and put it in my shirt pocket. Then realized that it was so easily found there. So, instead I put it on my tongue and swallowed it. I could feel it going all the way down. The tips of my fingers and toes became numb, as if I had swallowed some pill instead of a button. Then I sat back down in the electric chair, just as Mr. Green came back into the room and took his place across from me. I forced myself to stare at him straight in the eye, unwavering, pretending to be in total control of myself, of the situation, and of him. "I'm ready to listen, if you're ready to talk," he said. "I've nothing to say to you." I forced a rudeness into my voice that I had never shown to anyone before, much less an adult. Mr. Green was ready for this, as if he had been expecting it all along. "How much longer do you think you can keep up the lies, Jared? It's only a matter of time before the truth surfaces. We already have your button, and..." "What button?" He glanced down at the file, and the smug look on his face dissolved. "All right, give it back." Although I was feeling queasy, not from the button, but from the course I was choosing, I forced myself to grin. "I don't know what you're talking about," I said very slowly, pretending to be in control, keeping my eyes locked onto his. "I don't know, but maybe my own lurking discomfort coupled with that icy stare appeared suitably sociopathic to him, because he changed. He seemed a bit smaller, and maybe even frightened. "What are you trying to pull?" he asked. But I kept that grin painted across my face, and suddenly I realized that I was no longer pretending to be in control of the situation. I was. "Maybe I did all those things to Alec," I told Green, "but you'll never prove it, because I'm too smart for you." Then I stood up and strutted out of his office without looking back. If this was a witch trial, then I was not going to drown with a whimper. I would float in defiance. I would be the witch.